Our topic for the last session of the season is
this last one,
successes and failures of Israeli democracy.
So this for, is the last one?
Yes.
This season.
No, I'm not going to be around next week.
Oh, I wasn't.
Okay. So for the first maybe 15 minutes tonight, I want to discuss what I would have hoped to spend the whole session on, but we don't have time, and that is the Israeli presidency. Israel as a parliamentary democracy has a government which is run by the prime minister and a cabinet which emerges from the legislature. But, as with almost all good parliamentary systems, there is a head of state selected not by a popular vote of the citizenry, but by the parliament. Now, the original presidency of the state in the provisional period was for the first 2 days held by David Ben-Gurion as the chairman of the Provisional Council, but then Chaim Weizmann was appointed as the chairman of the Provisional Council, which was really a symbolic gesture on the part of Ben-Gurion and the boys who held the real authority. Weizmann was disappointed in receiving only this symbolic role, and when the state was established, he was in New York at the Waldorf Hotel, a Waldorf Astoria hotel, sort of crying in his soup that all the action is happening in Eretz Yisrael, and I'm here in New York. But he got word they want to make you the president, and he was very happy about that. At least he was going to get something.
What was he doing in New York?
Well, he, as a leading Zionist figure, was there to forestall trusteeship and other possible outcomes for British Mandate Palestine upon the expiration of the mandate, which was an important thing. Well, he's happy the state was established, and he's eventually happy that he's the head of the state, but he would have preferred to have real political power, not just a symbolic ceremonial role. He had no portfolio, none.
He was never a politician.
Of course he was a politician. In the 19-teens, 20s, and 30s, he was the head of the Zionist organization. He was the leader. He was sort of ousted from that slowly over time as Ben-Gurion and the folks who lived in Eretz Yisrael took control of the movement. And by the mid-40s, just upon the end of the war in 46, Weizmann was really out of office completely. But he was the elder statesman, and so they had to give him something. Now, in 1949, he was elected by the Knesset, in the first Knesset, to a term that was ill-defined, because actually it would be coterminous with the Knesset, not for a fixed number of years. And so he'd have to be re-elected in time for the second Knesset. Was he opposed? The answer is yes. He was opposed in 1949 by Joseph Klausner. Who was Joseph Klausner? What is he famous for? He's famous for writing about the Jewish Jesus. He was a professor at Hebrew University of classical Jewish history. And I mention his name just to show you that who is put forth as a candidate for the presidency? A cultural intellectual figure who is of no political consequence. That is the trend, at least for much of Israel's history, not anymore, that you put forth somebody with Judaic credentials who would be a nice figurehead at the top and will not compete for political power with the real politicians who run the cabinet.
So with Einstein, the same regard.
In the same vein, yeah. So Weizmann defeated Klausner. Klausner was put forth as an independent candidate by, I guess, the rightist and religious type parties, whereas Weizmann was put forth as the candidate of the Mapai party, despite the fact that Weizmann was a general Zionist, but he was a general Zionist who veered towards the left. Okay. Weizmann served until his death in 1952. And as I mentioned 8 months ago, 9 months ago, in 1952-53, Israel had a significant turnover of leadership because three figures disappeared from the scene, at least two of them permanently, one temporarily. David Ben-Gurion resigned, Chaim Weizmann died, and Harry Truman was out of office. So the big figures who were involved in the founding of the state were no longer around.
When did they fix the five-year term?
So the answer to that is in 1952. In 52, after Weizmann died, the question was who would succeed him. And this was when it was offered, at least in a half-baked way, to Albert Einstein, who said that he's flattered by the offer, but he doesn't like dealing with people, let alone wanting to deal with the Jewish state as it came about. Remember, Einstein was a great Zionist, But he actually was not such a lover of the State of Israel as it came to be in the last 7 years of his life. He had many reservations about the ethnocentrism or the hyper-nationalism of certain Zionist elements, and so his Zionism was really universalist Zionism of the Hebrew University. Along the lines of Judah Magnus, correct, and not along the lines of David Ben-Gurion. So he was out. Instead, Yitzchak Ben Zvi, who was a long-time labor Zionist leader, a Mapai fixture, a close collaborator with David Ben-Gurion, and the founder of the Ben Zvi Institute for the Study of Sephardic Jewry, or I should say Middle Eastern Jewry, he was elected president. His competition was Mordechai Nurak, who was the Maftal candidate, Yitzchak Rinbaum, the Polish Zionist leader who played an important role in the founding of the state, and Peretz Bernstein, the candidate who was the head of the General Zionists. But clearly Ben Zvi was going to win because the Mapai runs the state, and so he's going to win a presidential election since Mapai has the bulk of the Knesset members. And even though he wouldn't win in the first round, because he had to win a certain percentage of the ballot, he would win on a second round. In 1957 and in 1962, he would run unopposed. And the reason is because it's pasnish to run against the sitting president. It's a ceremonial position. Once a guy has it, you leave him alone. You don't run against him for the second term. It's not nice. So he won three terms, and he served 11 years in office and died in office in 1963. His successor was Zalman Shazar, Shlomo Zalman Rubashov, who was a Chabad chassid in his youth, and then veered off into labor Zionism, was a histadrut stalwart. He was also one of Golda Meir's lovers, despite being married to another woman. And he served for 10 years. He was elected in 63 and 68. And he was opposed again in 63 by Peretz Bernstein, the General Zionist candidate, who kept running and kept losing because he can't win since the General Zionists don't have the votes in the Knesset. The fourth president was Ephraim Katzir, who was a biophysicist, and he was elected to one term. He was opposed by Ephraim Urbach. Who's Ephraim Urbach? He's a scholar, a very important scholar of the Talmud, of rabbinic literature. He wrote the big 1,000-page volume on the sages, HaChachamim, and the Balei HaTosfot. So again, you have like a Judaic figure, a scholarly figure, who runs for the office but doesn't always win it. Instead, you have Katzir, who is a scientist. He didn't run for a second term. You were allowed to have two terms. He didn't run for a second term because his wife was ill and he just disappeared from the public eye. The fifth president was Yitzchak Navon.
Did you not mention the scandal?
Huh?
That was
Katsav
and Navon.
That's Katsav.
The scandal that made him resign.
No, you're talking about Katsav, not Katsir.
Yeah.
So Yitzchak Navon was the fifth president. He was a little bit different from the others. Navon was a politician. Unlike some of his predecessors who had been politicians and were already old and decrepit at that point, or had never been politicians, Navon was an active politician. He had been a Mapainik, and in 1965, when Rafi was founded by Ben-Gurion, he, together with Dayan and Peres, established Rafi. He was an up-and-coming figure. He was also Sephardic. He's the first ever non-Ashkenazic president. He was of Turkish and Turkish and Iraqi background. He served for one term, and then decided, you know what, he doesn't want to run for a second term. He wants to get back into active politics, and he would serve as Minister of Education throughout the 1980s. The sixth president was probably the more famous of the more recent ones, and that is Chaim Herzog. Herzog had a lot going for him when he was elected in 83. He was sort of like the George H.W. Bush of Israel, in the sense that he held every possible position. He was a Haganah officer, he was a British Army officer, he was the head of IDF military intelligence, he was the ambassador to the UN, he had done everything.
He had yichus.
His father had been the chief rabbi, his brother had been a major diplomat and staffer in the Prime Minister's office. The Herzog family was like the royal family of Israel, almost. He served two terms, and he was opposed in 1988 by Menachem Elon, again, a Judaic scholar. Who's Menachem Elon? He was a member of the Israeli Supreme Court, an Orthodox Jew. His claim to fame was that he had tried to introduce Mishpat Ivri into Israeli law, to try to combine elements of Talmudism with modern jurisprudence. Correct, a very important book on that, Mishpat Ivri. After Herzog served two terms, in 1993, Ezer Weitzman was elected. Now, just one thing about Herzog. It's interesting. He was the Labor Party candidate, and he was elected in 1983. That should come as a bit of a surprise, because which party was in government in 1983?
Likud.
So despite controlling the cabinet and the government, they couldn't get their guy elected president. They lost on a closed ballot, which explains it. On a closed ballot, members of the coalition are free to vote however they want, and no one's going to know who voted how. And so Herzog, who was an illustrious figure and is a perfectly reasonable candidate, secured sufficient number of votes. Weizmann was the Labor Party candidate in 93, and he defeated Dov Shalansky, who was a Likud politician. But Weizmann, although he would win again in 98, would eventually have to resign over financial allegations and scandals about things that happened before his presidency. Because of that, because of scandal in the presidency, it was determined that you could no longer run for two terms of 5 years each, but rather you would be elected to one term of 7 years and that's it. One term of 7 years and that's it. Well, after he Weizmann resigned, so you had Dalia Itzik served as interim president very briefly because she was the Speaker of the Knesset, and then a new election. And in this election, Moshe Katsav defeated Shimon Peres by a vote of 63-57. This is despite the fact that Barak was the prime minister and Labor controlled the government. Again, the opposition party won the presidency. Why? Because Shimon Peres was the candidate. And who likes Shimon Peres? Less than the majority of the public, as a general rule. So Katsav was able to win. He was able to siphon off a few Sephardic votes from the other side of the aisle, and he wanted a close vote, 63-57.
He's
Sephardi,
right?
He was Iranian. Yeah, Persian. He came, born in the 45, he made Aliyah. Yeah, huh?
He came to Yeshiva University.
Yeah?
Was Weizmann,
he did not speak English, by the way.
No, he didn't, no. Yeah.
Was Weizmann still active in politics up to the time he was elected president?
Not exactly, because he had not been invited to join Rabin's government, as far as I can remember. He was not I don't know if he was an active Knesset member. He may have already resigned, but he was a popular figure who was well-liked in certain circles, but he was not a government minister at the time. Ezer Weizmann, the nephew of Chaim. So Katsav resigned in disgrace over the Aleph episode of rape allegations, and he eventually served some time in jail. And so he made a big busha cherpa for Am Yisrael, Katsav. He's out of jail now and roams the streets. In 2007, you have another election. And this time, Shimon Peres was going to run and was going to win. And they were going to make sure he was going to win. Because he was so old at this point that he was a threat to nobody, and even his detractors figured he deserves it to finally get something in life. Now, there were other candidates in the race. There was Dalia Itzik. There was Binyamin Ben Eliezer. Rabbi Yisrael Meir Lau was thought to be a candidate. He had been 4 years removed from being the chief rabbi of Israel. Meir Shamgar, a member of the Supreme Court, and an Orthodox Jew, also was thought to be a candidate. Khaled Avital, of Salute to Israel Parade fame, was also a candidate. But in the end, most of the candidates dropped out, and Rabbi Lau was never a candidate, because Shelly Yachimovich, who was a journalist at the time and would later go on to be the Labor Party leader, threatened Rabbi Lau that if he put his name as in the hat for as a candidate, that certain unpleasant things about his past would be exposed. Verwest. Okay. So, and he didn't run. So, Shimon Peres ultimately runs largely unopposed, and he wins. There was an attempt to pass the Peres Law, What is the Peres law? The Peres law was that you'd have an open ballot for the presidential race on the thinking that if it were a closed ballot, all of Shimon's detractors would vote against him and get their jollies quietly. But if it was an open ballot, like it would be unseemly to vote against a guy after he's been the elder statesman of Israel for so many years. In the end, that law did not pass. It remained a closed ballot, but despite the fact that it was a closed ballot, Peres won as the Kadima candidate at a time when Kadima ran the government under Ehud Olmert. And so Peres functioned quite nicely as president for 7 years. He was feted by the international community, would go to all these big dinners in Europe and in America, and represented startup nation of Israel, 21st century Israel. No longer nuclear weapons, Shimon Peres, no longer IDF, defense ministry executive, Shimon Peres. Rather, universalist 21st century Shimon. And I remember I met him. The one time I met Shimon Peres was at an appeal of conscience dinner with Rabbi Schneier. This was in 2009. You were at that dinner? And he spoke nicely. And they loved him. All the Gentiles loved him at that time.
How much did he get?
I don't know.
I've heard this, okay. Guy.
Now, in 2014, Reuven Rivlin, who had been the Speaker of the Knesset, was elected president. He defeated Meir Shitrit of Kadima. And this is a trend where the Speaker of the Knesset eases his way into the presidency. And my guess is the same thing will happen to Yuli Edelstein, that 2 years from now, when Rivlin's term is over, assuming there's no major shakeup in the Israeli political structure in it, and Yuli becomes the prime minister or anything like that, assuming it doesn't happen, likely he will go from the speakership to be the president. And it'll be a good choice because Yuli Edelstein is a good guy. Okay, so the president doesn't have much power other than tapping the person to become the prime ministerial designate after an election, and that's really about it, other than the occasional pardon. But in Israel, you rarely ever have a presidential pardon. In the 1980s, you had it with Herzog after the Bus 300 affair. If you remember, the Bus 300 affair where they butchered to death the terrorists, and it was a big scandal, Herzog resolved it with a convenient pardon at the right time in 1986. So other than that, it's just a ceremonial role. I should say this. Sometimes the president is able to conduct diplomacy that a more bellicose prime minister can't conduct. And so, for example, Yitzhak Navon was credited with greasing the wheels with Sadat at a time when there was a breakdown in the relationship with Menachem Begin. Supposedly that's what happened. So you could understand why that a president who doesn't have to worry about partisan politics can play a peacemaker role even in diplomacy, international affairs, that maybe the prime minister couldn't do if given the opportunity. Okay, now enough with the presidency. That was al regel achat. We covered all 10. Let's now discuss the successes and failures.
Has played a role in recent role in the election?
Well, Rivlin played less of a role than theoretically he could have. Had the Knesset not been dissolved, he could have tapped somebody else like Gantz to form a government, and he could have inserted himself into the equation to a great deal. He didn't, because the opportunity kind of was stolen from him. All right, so be it.
And there may be pressure on him to pardon Bibi eventually down the road.
That is certainly the case, and my guess is that if Bibi is eliminated from public life, a pardon will be forthcoming. Okay, so let's now talk about, to sum up all the years' discussions, what were the successes and failures of the Israeli political system? So first and foremost, the democracy survived. Let's compare the state of Israel to the state of play of several other countries that came about in the post-World War II era that did not have democracies remain intact. I mean, for example, Pakistan was established in 1947, the division of India, and had Musharraf, was basically a military dictator for a good decade. Not all late 40s originated states preserved their democracy. Israel did all the way through, and it's the democratic character of the state improved over time, meaning there were certain complaints that Ben-Gurion and Isser Harel ran basically a dictatorial police state in the early years, and there was a lot of truth to that, but that's no longer the case. And as much as you complain that Bibi is trying to subvert the system, but there is a system, and it's been functioning for 7 decades. So,
how do you compare Israel to India?
To India? India is a very robust democracy. I mean, they have elections involving hundreds of thousands of citizen voters.
I don't think they have, you know, so many factions in India.
No, you basically have Hindus and Muslims, and then you have economic divide between left and right. You don't have as peculiar an ethnic structure as you do in Israel because of Kibbutz Galuyot. You have a wide range of people from diverse backgrounds.
First of all, you had the Congress Party was in power.
It was the Mapai Party of India.
Right. I mean, for decades.
For decades.
But they actually have many, many small parties in India because it really is a very disparate country, but you have a couple of the major powers.
Well, also because you're not dealing with only 120 seats in the legislature, you're dealing with hundreds and hundreds of seats. You have the opportunity for more types of people with different political opinion to enter into the fold. Okay. Now, the next point I wanted to make was, and this very issue, the long-term governing party, that of Mapai Labor, it was not the best thing for Israel to have a governing party for 4 or 5 decades. But eventually, there was a competitive two-party system that emerged in the 1980s and 90s. Of course, you could argue that since the 1990s, it's been back to a one-party rule, that the Likud dominates and the other side of the aisle has no chance. I mean, if we just examine it carefully, from 1933 through 1977, Labor Mapai was in charge the whole time, in the 15 years of the Yishuv era, and then for the first 29 years of statehood. But since 1977, Likud has been in government for 32 out of the last 42 years. And of the 10 that they weren't in government, 4 of those were Kadima, which was a breakaway from Likud. Really, Labor has only been in power, or the left, you could say, has only been in power for 6 out of the last 42 years. So you have almost a flip of what was. You have a governing party. But the truth is, Likud never became a governing party, like in the sense of Mapai. Since it doesn't control the all the structures of government at the municipal and the regional level, or for that matter, it doesn't control the press, it doesn't control the intelligentsia. Likud runs the government, the cabinet, but that's about it. Whereas Mapai really was the dominant force and controlled every facet of life.
How strong is his group today?
Not at all. Not at all. So, and if we just try to give a timeline of when the two-party system was at its peak, so the two-party system begins in earnest in 1965 with the merger on the left side of Achdut HaAvodah and Mapai, and the merger on the right side of the General Zionist / Liberal Party with Chirut to form Gachal. It then consolidates even further in 73 with the establishment of the Likud, and then with Likud's first victory in 77, so that the 80s and the 90s are the high point of the two-party system. Okay. And that it would be nice if Israel could return to that. The problem is that it can't, because there's only one issue of any significance anymore, and that is the disposition of the territories, and one side of the aisle has been discredited. So you don't have an opportunity for the left side to win. At best, you could have a centrist party try to unseat Likud, which almost happened a few weeks ago. Okay, now the next point, number 3. True electoral reform was never implemented. The direct election of prime minister was attempted, you know, for a brief period. It happened 3 times in 96, 99, and 01, and was scrapped because it was an abysmal failure, and the outcome was not what the prognosticators had assumed. The other thing that has changed over time was the raising of the threshold from 1.1% to 3.25%. But as much as 3.25% does eliminate the most fringe of parties, it's still not very high. And you can't say that that's significant constitutional reform. What would have been major constitutional reform would have been the emergence of local constituencies and your local congressmen, something that Ben-Gurion had always wanted and never happened. And it never happened because it would have resulted in the demise of certain parties that are not geographically based but are sectoral. So it just never came to pass. Well, the American system of electing an executive president is foreign to the Zionist experience. And as for local parliamentary districts, it would have meant that the sectoral parties don't stand a chance outside of the rare area where they're dominant. Like, in other words, Aguda could win in Bnei Brak, or maybe in Yerushalayim, but the Maftal could win nowhere, and the Russians could win nowhere, because nowhere are they the majority. If you want to have diverse representation, you can't have local districts. I mean, the Arabs would do well in the Triangle, but that's about it.
Could they bring Netanya or something?
Maybe they could, yeah, but it would not be according to their true demographic totals. All right. Now, one of the biggest successes of Israeli democracy, I think this is the biggest success, aside from the fact that the democracy was sustained, is that all significant subgroups within society have maintained their representation throughout the decades, including what you might regard as marginal groups: the Arabs, the Haredim, the Sephardim, the Russians, the National Religious, the Peaceniks, and the Hawks. Have always had representation when they needed it. The Arabs from day one. Now, granted, from the beginning, the Arab representation was really satellite Mapai parties and not expressing the true sentiment of Arab nationalism. That only happened starting in the 1970s and 80s. But, and you might say as a avowed Zionist, that's a bad thing. You know, who needs a pro-Palestinian people in the Knesset? But from a purely democratic point of view, I'm happy, quote-unquote, to see that the Hanan Zoabis of the world can say whatever they want to say from the rostrum, because they represent a certain constituency. They should be booed, but, you know, they're entitled to be elected.
What have the Arabs done, the Arab representatives done for the Arab populace?
Drafting of legislation that does help them in the social realm. It's not the sort of thing you would notice, or I would notice. It's the sort of thing that on the ground... granted, yeah. Okay, but it could be worse. I don't know. Yeah.
So was there for a constituency among the Arabs having loyalty to the Jewish state?
Well, a success of the Israeli system has been that from the beginning there were elements within the Arab public that were truly loyal to the Zionist state, and voted not grudgingly but willingly for Zionist parties, typically Mapai in the beginning. They were not the majority of the Israeli Arabs, but they were the best represented in the early years. Okay, so the Arabs have had their representation, and that's a good thing from a democratic point of view. As for the Haredim, so they've always had something. Sometimes more, sometimes less. In recent years, because of their demographic expansion, a lot more, but even from the first election, 1949, the United Religious Bloc had 16 seats, and the Aguda was well represented. So they can't complain that they've been shut out politically. If they've shut themselves out, it was by their own choosing not to participate in cabinets from 52 to 77. But other than that 25-year period, they've been involved all the way through. What about the Sephardim? So Sephardic underrepresentation in parliament was a problem in the bad old days of the Mapai, when the Sephardic, the Edot HaMizrach, were not treated in the best way. But they have been integrated into the political system, and with the emergence of the ethno-religious slates in the 1980s of Tami and then Shas, you have who to vote for if you want to vote for an ethnic party or a religious ethnic party. The Ethiopians, it's interesting, they never had a significant enough demographic base to run their own party that would actually cross the threshold. But they were wooed by the major parties, Labour and Likud, and have had over the years representation on both sides of the aisle, including Tammy Basato, I forget her name, she's now a representative from Blue and White, number 20-something on the list, and pretty good parliamentarian. But they've had, over the years, I think 4 or 5 Ethiopian representatives in the Knesset. The Russians had since 1996 Yisrael Baliyah and Yisrael Beitenu. And as for the National Religious, from day one, the Maftal was an important cog in the wheel, although they've had their problems over the last decade and a half in terms of their identity, and there is no truly religious Zionist party anymore. It's just an element of the Union of Right-Wing Parties. And as for the Peaceniks and the Hawks, well, they have their representation in the two major parties, or the more extreme versions, like Meretz or the National Union. So any ideology other than the worst extremes can find someone in the parliament to be the standard bearer. Okay. Number 5. A failure was that no constitution was ever adopted. That instead the Harari proposal of basic laws has been the method of constitutional change ever since 1950. This is a failure, but one which we have to just accept, because the early thought that there could be a constitution successfully drafted was a pie-in-the-sky dream. It could never have happened. There are too many differences of opinion over matters of religion and state and over other issues that make the Harari method not ideal, but better than nothing. Okay. Next point. This is a related point. The relationship of church and state was never properly resolved. It's always been on an ad hoc basis and an ongoing fight. Could it have been handled better? Maybe, and maybe not. We don't know. There were moments when the divide over issues of religion and state were intense. For example, in the early 50s and then again in 1970 and then again in 1988 over amending the law of return and who was a Jew. And later issues involving the Kotel Plaza and egalitarian prayer, or the ever-recurring question about civil marriage and abolishing the Rabbanut's control over marriage. Yes, these things pop up periodically, and they're never fully resolved, and they never will be. And the reason why they won't be is because the status quo, as it has morphed over time, has favored the religious side of things, and as the demographics tilt towards the religious constituency in Israel, it's not going to be, the trend is not going to be reversed. Let's put it that way. At least I don't think so. Well, there's a good question. What if there was no coercion whatsoever in matters of religion? What would Israel look like? What if there was civil marriage? And what if there was no Rabbanut monopoly over Kashrut or any of the things of which they have significant authority? What would Israel look like today? I don't know.
They would have the same thing. They would just not abide by the law, whatever you want to call it. They would still have their own rabbis.
You know, it's in the subjunctive because we don't know. We don't know. Next point. This is, I think, the biggest failure. If the biggest success was that all the various ideological groups and demographic groups have been represented, it's a big success. The single biggest failure is not the issue of religion and state, it's not the issue of a lack of a constitution, it is that Israeli political parties, including the major parties, which have run governments over the years, have never articulated, and in my view, never even internally come to their own conclusion about the disposition of the West Bank and Gaza, but especially the West Bank. Meaning, we don't know if there were a willing Arab partner that truly had peaceful intentions. We don't know what the state of Israel, as governed by a Likud party government or a Kadima or Labor, what they would have been willing to give away to their Arab interlocutor and what they would not be willing to give away. What does Benjamin Netanyahu, in his own mind, have as the final border of Israel? Lu Yitzur, if you could imagine that there was a peaceful party on the other side of that border. We have no clue.
But you know what Ehud Barak would have
been. Okay, so Ehud Barak is the rare exception, and maybe Ehud Olmert is an exception. But we don't really know what the right side of the aisle has in mind, and they keep winning. And they're in charge. They're the bosses. Why does this matter? You could say it doesn't matter. After all, there's no willing peace partner on the other side. Well, it does matter. I'll tell you why. Because the settlements, in the view of everybody outside of Israel and on the left side within Israel, are identified as an obstacle to peace. The right says, oh, you can't say such a thing. It's sacrilege. Except that the left side is entirely right. But the left side is wrong. If you can envision a scenario whereby those territories that Israel intends to keep are where they place Jewish settlers, and those territories where they have no intention of keeping, there are no Jewish settlers, then Shalom al Yisrael, everything would be fine. What's the problem? We don't know where that boundary is. That boundary does not exist, not in anybody's mind, and certainly not in the realm of political discourse.
We now have the situation.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then the rest of it will go who knows what. How do you think that's going to play?
So if...
There's an aggressive...
Okay, so if Trump, as the American president, is basically supporting a quasi-Alone plan, where Israel gets to annex like 30% of the West Bank, where they have major settlement blocks. And the rest can become the wild Palestinian West, and whatever's behind the fence nobody cares about because it's behind the fence. But Israel gets to keep a good chunk of the territory. That would be a very nice thing for Israel, that the American president would support what had historically been the Alon plan, roughly, give or take a few percentage points. But the problem is, have Israeli governments since the late 1970s been playing by those boundaries? They haven't been. They've been catering to the settler audience, and so now it's hard to fathom the drawing of a clear border. And if you're a rabidly right-wing Zionist, you say, good, there shouldn't be any border, there should be Jews everywhere. Fine, if that's your point of view. But if your point of view is you want to have some sort of a final arrangement with a more expansive border for Israel, but an actual border, then you have to come up with some coherent plan. And there never was a coherent plan. It's a major failing on the part of Israel.
Because simply the blocks where Jews have settled,
yeah,
are all over the place. So you
right, know. So it was a historic blunder. It was a historic blunder to make that happen.
Well,
yeah.
It was sold originally, it was sold as the idea that these settlements are going to be a protective...
Right, that was the biggest lie that it was ever espoused.
The ones along the Jordan River are small.
I've heard actually a general talk about it. It was the reverse, because now you have those people there, so you first have to defend the people.
So the truth of the matter, the truth of the matter is about these kind of settlements in politically sensitive areas of the territories is that they never served a security purpose, but rather their presence was a post facto justification for the military presence, for those who wanted to sustain a military presence. So it was everyone was fed a package of lies in order to justify a scenario whereby the army is spread out everywhere, for those who wanted that to happen. Okay, now, yeah.
They talk about areas A, B, and C.
Yeah.
And I'm totally confused.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
What
yeah.
they designate A, B, and C. And then, that's number one. And then number two, wasn't there an idea of making some sort of elevated roads?
Oh, sure, yeah, yeah. Because the elevated road was thought to be a connection between Gaza and the West Bank near Hebron, and to connect Judea and Samaria, circumventing Jerusalem between Jerusalem and Maale Adumim. The reality is that the Palestinians are not going to get easy access from one to the other. There are Jewish bypass roads just because Jews control the country. But getting back to my point about... Well, A is purely Palestinian control. B is mixed, Palestinian, civilian, Israeli military. C is all Israel. So, but just to conclude my point about how Israel never produced its own plan, the reason why it never happened is very simple. To produce a plan necessarily means to give up permanently on whatever you're not claiming in the moment. That whatever you're claiming, you're claiming, and maybe the international community will accept it, maybe they won't. Whatever you're not claiming is gone forever. Gone forever. And no right of center Israeli government was ever willing to make that move, other than Sharon's unilateral disengagement. Yeah.
There's always this business about, let's go back to the Six-Day War rules.
Uh-huh.
Were they borders?
Well, no Israelis, no Israelis outside of Ratz or Meretz ever seriously considered that. Even the Labour Party didn't really want to do that. So,
no, that's our point.
No significant political party that could. I'm saying, but no party that ever ran the country ever seriously considered that. Okay, now, next point. There was never a military takeover. Civilian control was retained, and though many top generals have had prominent political careers, civilian control of the military has been maintained throughout. Now, that's not to say that there weren't moments when the civilian leadership sort of abdicated responsibility in favor of military guidance. Most notably when, right before the Six-Day War, when the civilian leadership was inept and Rabin was expected to come up with all these plans and he had a mental breakdown. So there have been moments in the 1980s, especially during the Lebanon War, when the civilian leadership was proving itself inept and the military, or at least the Minister of Defense, acting almost as a military figure himself, was doing things that maybe he shouldn't have done. Okay, next point. and this is a positive, extremists have been kept out of the government. But the negative is, the basis for doing so has seemed to be arbitrary over the years. In other words, there are laws on the books that allow you to delegitimize a party on the basis of racist credo, or denying Jewish character to the state, democratic character to the state, but the implementation of that is necessarily going to be chaotic, to say the least, and subject to criticism that it was unfair, unjust.
But it'd be chaotic if they were in anyway.
Huh?
What is the logic when you look at like you say in the Senate, you see a couple Arab nutjobs screaming all day.
Yeah.
You know, we paying them money, they're making money to buy bullets to shoot at us. That makes the, what sense does it make?
Okay, so the idea that a treasonous figure has to be eliminated from the parliament is a very reasonable concept. It's just that how are you going to define the treason?
Was Kahana the only one?
So Kahana was not the only one to be disqualified. Over the years, a bunch of people have been disqualified, and some have even been declared persona non grata by the state, most notably Azmi Bishara, who ran off with the state secrets to Syria. But from a Jewish point of view, was Kahana the only one? No, there were other Kahana-like figures in the last two decades. Michael Ben-Ari or something.
One of those guys
was disqualified. Okay, next point. Corruption.
Could they ever represent the emperor's danger to Israel?
Who?
The Kahanas.
Well, in the early 80s, the Jewish terror underground committed a couple of really nasty acts and threatened to blow up the Dome of the Rock. I mean, the TNT, Terror Negative Terror, was a problem. And in the early 1950s, there was a terror group that was a holdover from the days of Lehi. They wanted the Mamlechet Yisrael, the Brit HaBiryonim, or Brit HaKanaim, were territorial expansionists and wanted a theocratic state. The chief rabbi in his youth, Eliyahu, was in that group. Okay, so you have on occasion Jews who are real extremists and could be present a problem. Next point: corruption. Corruption has ensnared way too many top officials, much more so than you would expect from a fully functioning democracy. So that's bad. On the other hand, the positive is when they get caught, they get punished, for the most part. I mean, what happens with Bibi, it depends if he's convicted, and if we'll see. But let's just go through some of the cases of high-level figures. Moshe Katsav was convicted of rape. Ehud Olmert was convicted of bribery. Aryeh Deri was convicted of bribery. Asher Yadlin, Yonah Metzger, Eliyahu Bakshi Doron, Omri Sharon, Yair Levy, Aaron Abuchatzeret, Tzachi Hanegbi, Yitzchak Mordechai, all either sexual crimes or graft crimes. So we're dealing with two chief rabbis, a president... actually two presidents, a prime minister, many, many cabinet officials, and a bunch of lower-level officials. So this is not good, but at least they get caught and they get prosecuted. Okay. Next point. And if I were an Israeli citizen, this would really bother me. You don't always get what you vote for. This is a real serious problem in Israel, that people run on a certain platform... and they change their mind dramatically in office. So, for example, so it happens in every democracy, but it has been especially true in Israel over the last 25 years. It was not true in Israel in the first 40, 50 years of statehood, but in the last quarter century, it has been especially true on both sides of the aisle, going in either direction. So, for example, in 1999, well, let's start in 1992. Yitzhak Rabin ran a platform of not talking to the PLO. Then what happened? He talked to the PLO. In 1999, Barak ran a centrist campaign in which he positioned himself barely to the left of Bibi, but more competent than Bibi, and yet he gave away the store in Camp David, offered major compromise. Sharon ran in 2001 and 2003 on a rightist campaign, basically on the riding the the tradition of him being a bulldozer and bullying the enemy into submission. And what happened? He capitulated more than anybody else. What happened? In 2003, he ran against Amram Mitzna. Amram Mitzna called for a separation of Israel and Palestinians, and Sharon laughed at that. And then he did it himself. He built the wall and disengaged from Gaza. So Mitzna, who was a laughingstock and lost, his ideas were put into practice. Bibi, in 2009, ran a campaign against Tzipi Livni and against Kadima, that Kadima was going to give away the store and was going a two-state type party, and that Bibi was a Likudnik of the traditional variety, and there wasn't going to be a two-state solution. And then what happened? A month after he's elected, he gives a speech at Bar-Ilan University in which he announces two-state solution. Now, everybody who was watching that speech, and I remember watching it live, said, ah, he's full of it. He's not really going to do a two-state solution. This is just for the cameras to placate Obama or whomever, the Americans, the Europeans, but he doesn't really mean it. Now, I think a decade later, he didn't mean it, and there is no two-state solution. But on the surface level, he just went against his whole campaign, following in the trend of all of his predecessors to run on one thing and do another.
Yeah, but you can't make a decision. They might have been the first day, yes, they would do it. But if the Arabs do what they do, they have to make changes.
All right, so, Les, yes, every politician has to work on the fly and deal with the cards they're dealt. But when you know in your mind during the campaign that you intend in the first year of your term to do things on the diplomatic front and the political front, on the international front, that are significantly at odds with your explicit platform and slogan and maybe consistent with your competitor's slogan, then you're deceiving the public. Okay,
that's what you're there for,
deceive the public. Well, and it came and it went. So now the next point, which is a related point of not knowing whether your candidate is going to actually do what they say, is the demise of ideological parties. That Zionism, from 1900, basically, really from 1898 up through the first few decades of statehood, had very strong ideological parties. That ever since General Zionism, Herzlian, Weizmann-type General Zionism, gave way to revisionism on the right, labor Zionism in all of its various varieties on the left, religious Zionism on the right, basically, you have strong ideological sentiment. Whether the issue is Eretz Yisrael Hashlema versus peace, whether the issue is socialism versus capitalism, religion versus secularism, you have a very strong opinion about things. And when you're voted into office, people know you stand for this and not that. Well, that has gone away. Now, one of the reasons why that went away is because economic issues cease to be such a divisive point. Meaning in the old days, you had Mapai, Achdut Avoda, Shomer HaTzair, and other fringe, Maki, all on the left on economic issues and some social issues too. And then you had the Progressive Party, the Liberal Party, the General Zionist Party on the right. So there's bourgeois capitalists versus socialists. That no longer matters. Everybody's a capitalist now. And in fact, the left side is more capitalist than the right side, because the right side still has sort of a populist element, the Herut-style populism in the Likud, which favors a welfare state for the poor, as opposed to the Tony Ashkenazim who live in the fancy suburbs, who are pure capitalism and pure business. So the roles have kind of flipped over time, but it's really not a divisive issue anymore. All right, and peace. The peace process is not as nearly as a divisive issue anymore, because nobody thinks that the Arabs are ready for a compromise. And so it's not like it was in the 80s and 90s when you think, oh, if the other side wins, it's disaster. Either we'll have a Palestinian state or we'll have a one state and all will be ruined. Nobody really worries about these things anymore, because there's just we muddle along going with the status quo. I don't know. I'm not so sure. So, because the issues are no longer animating the public, what you have instead is you're voting for a personality. And certain personalities tend to do better than others. Like Bibi does well, despite the fact that he's reviled by many, he's liked by enough people that he wins. All right, because there aren't so many ideological issues dividing people anymore, they have the issues have to be manufactured. For example, who manufactured a crisis this time around? Lieberman. Yes, he's not in favor of the Haredi draft exemption, sure. But maybe it's baloney. Maybe he just manufactured a crisis because he wants to do well for himself.
He
doesn't like Bibi. So again, personality is what's driving things, not the issue. And that's not good. It's better when the issues drive the election cycle. Yeah, I had a question here.
But doesn't your party keep you at a certain angle? How could the Prime Minister totally go against what his whole party stands for?
The answer to that is they usually can't. However, Sharon was able to do it in 2005. And he was able to do it by the force of his personality, that those who disagreed with him, some of them left the party, and then when he couldn't win everybody over, he left the party with a majority of the remaining MKs to form Kadima. So he pulled a stunt, the likes of which had never been pulled before, and probably will never be pulled again, but he got away with it. And not only did he get away with it, but that party won the next election.
How true was that?
It was definitely true from 1949 to 1966. They were under military administration. Their lives were horrible. And now, listen,
that's a big thing. But if you talk about American Jewry, uh-huh, and the left, and their humanitarian values, and the fact that they're sour on Israel,
yeah,
that's a big sticking point.
So the answer is that the Arab citizens of Israel today have full political rights, the voting rights, they can elect whoever they want, and they're integrated in the economy to the extent that they would like to participate, and they get educated and go to the highest levels of professional life.
Is garbage collected?
The answer is yes, but in certain areas, it's not the state's fault that you have a depressed character to the neighborhood, because not every segment of the population is going to be as materially successful as others. So, whereas Ra'anana has no graffiti and no garbage in the street, if you go to Umm al-Fakham, you're going to have some graffiti and garbage in the street. It's inevitable. I wouldn't blame the state, no. They don't want to.
Stay in Israel.
Correct. There's no interest in leaving Israeli citizenship. Absolutely true.
And
okay.
Another question is,
yeah.
Do you think Sharon not done what he did in Gaza, and we were still there, we would be having these problems?
I think a Gaza withdrawal was almost inevitable. I think that a Gaza withdrawal, I don't think that made the rocket fire any more possible or less possible. I think that rocket fire could have happened regardless.
Even if we were still there.
Even if there was an IDF presence in Gaza, because it wasn't in Gaza City or Rafah. It was in the surrounding the settlements. And it was in Gush Katif, Kfar Darom. The army had withdrawn already in 1994 from the lion's den of Gaza. It was only protecting the remaining settlements. And so from Area A of Gaza, you could have had real bad behavior. And you did in the 1990s. So I think it could have escalated even into the 2000s.
You say it was inevitably, they could not hold Gaza.
I mean, it could have happened, but it would have been at a high price, a very high price. Yeah.
Am I mistaken in it? It wasn't what happened and how it happened.
So
the
speed with which it happened is what adversely affected the Jews who had lived there and was bad for their lives. From an international diplomatic point of view, that I don't think it made much of a difference, the speed with which it happened. I think that the bottom line is that the PA lost to Hamas very quickly after withdrawal. And Hamas had no interest in behaving nicely, and they still don't have any interest in behaving nicely. And the sad point is that the Likud government of the last 10 years favors Hamas maintaining control in Gaza. They do not want a PA takeover, because a PA takeover in Gaza necessarily advances the ball of the peace process vis-a-vis the West Bank, and the Likud party would like to retain control of the bulk of the West Bank. So therefore, it requires Hamas's continued presence in Gaza as the ruling party. Now, we don't say that in public, in front of CNN, but Lamaisa, that's the truth, okay? Well, Sharon himself had calculated that we'll sacrifice Gaza for the sake of the West Bank.
But you don't think if they had real elections in the West Bank that Hamas wouldn't win there?
I don't know. Maybe they would.
The
PA is not liked. Okay, so one last point, then with this we'll stop for the season. The one downside of the political history is that Ashkenazic men have dominated the system at the top. That there's only been one woman prime minister, Golda Meir, and Golda Meir was not a woman. Golda Meir was Golda Meir. And her success, by her own thinking, was not a feminist success, it was a Golda success. That she was in it for herself, not for her gender. Yeah.
She was
gold. She was gold, yeah.
Her name could have been gold.
Yeah, yeah.
It could have been silver. Whatever it was.
It was her.
She was her.
Yeah.
She had her own man. She had her own man.
Yeah. And the other thing is that no non-Ashkenazic man has taken over the reins as prime minister, and that no Shomer Shabbos person has held the reign of prime minister. Menachem Begin was the closest thing you had to a religious Jew holding that seat, but still, it's always been, for the most part, secular-leaning Ashkenazic men. Yeah.
Out of left field, but maybe, do you have any information or comment on the evolution of the Israeli court system on Israeli politics? Yeah.
So the answer is that the court tried to avoid interfering in the affairs of state up until the 1980s, and then under Barak started interfering more and more. The trend over the last 30 years has been for the High Court to come down and issue rulings saying that a certain practice of the state is illegal, and to give the government a window of opportunity to correct the problem, meaning it doesn't have to be changed immediately. It's not like in the United States, where if a Supreme Court rules something that day, it's totally overturned. The court gives the government X number of months or a year to resolve the matter by legislation. And if by legislation, which passes constitutional muster, the matter is resolved, then the matter is resolved. But for example, the Haredi draft exemption was a classic case. The Tal law, that the court said what you have now of the defense minister's own fiat is not good enough. He can't just act unilaterally, like arbitrarily like that. You have to have a law on the books. So you have X number of months to pass a law, and the Knesset passed some kind of a law. But the law has to also pass muster in the sense that it can't be overtly discriminatory. It has to have provisions that at least... Okay, there's no constitution, but the Supreme Court has threatened and has struck down laws that are a violation of some basic law that requires equitable distribution of the burden, or whatever it is. So the court does get involved, but not along the same lines as the American Supreme Court.
In a few days, we'll be commemorating the 65th anniversary of Brown.
Yeah.
And that's the liberal spirit. I mean, we haven't had integration, truly, yet.
That's true. All right, with this, we'll stop.